I've had a wonderful time. I hope you have too. Please join me in thanking the organizers of the conference, the speakers for giving some really cool talks, and the Perimeter staff for putting on a wonderful time. All right. So I'd like to tell you about a project that me and Wei-Cheng Ye and Matthew Yu did last year. Wei-Cheng, I think, is here. So let's see. So it's up on archive. So if you'd rather read than listen, you can go do that. And so I'm going to walk you through some of the context of, like, okay, well, what do we mean? What kinds of anomalies are we looking at? How do we access them? And then inevitably, you know, how is there Bordism in there? Because that's the way I love to think about these things. So I hope you enjoy the story I'm about to tell you. So what we're looking at is, this is a three-dimensional question. And so what that means is we're going to be studying modular tensor categories, or, you know, maybe slight variants thereof. And so you'll notice that I'm couching this in what Wikipedia calls weasel words. Because, you know, many, some, typically, because I don't want to say I'm saying something about every three-dimensional, like, quantum field theory or something. Or I want to talk about a nice class of three-dimensional topological field theories described by things called modular tensor categories. And so that's sort of where we begin. And in particular, if I have a symmetry of that, what does that mean? So the first way that we all learn to think about symmetry is to say, okay, what is a symmetry? It's saying a group acts on something. And so I'm going to call that the algebraic way of putting a G symmetry on a 3D TFT. So, okay, you know, for example, in the last several days, people have mentioned multiple times the toric code has a Z2 symmetry where you swap E and M. So that's, you know, described in that way, that's an algebraic symmetry. A thing you could also do, though, is you could say, well, these things are field theories, and what does it mean to have a G symmetry on a field theory? Well, I guess, okay, that's a question that we've all spent a lot of time pondering. But one answer that I learned is that the field theoretic notion is saying you can couple to a background gauge field for your group. So if I am a topologist, so I'm implicitly thinking about discrete groups here, so I don't have to worry about connections. If you're looking at Lie groups here, you should probably say, like, principal G bundle with connection. But since I'm saying topological field theory, I can't do that. So the point is algebraic, or throw in a G bundle to your stack of fields. So two kinds of G symmetry. It would be wonderful if these were the same, if different perspectives shone the same light on the thing we want to study, but they're not. This notion is stronger than this one. And the name of the game typically in this, you know, in this story is to say, well, these are easy to cook up because you have a description of the category. And so you can actually write down, okay, I have these anions, I move them around in this way. But does that actually extend to the stronger notion, which we might want to use for a variety of reasons? So the obstruction to this is what I'm going to call an anomaly. Now, if at this conference you asked four people what an anomaly is, you'd probably get about five answers. And I think I'd be responsible for at least two of them. So in particular, you know what I'm going to say on the next slide about what I think an anomaly is. So I am not making some sort of general statement about this is all anomalies. This is some, like, I'm saying in this setting, this is what I want to think of as the anomaly, is saying this is an obstruction. And how I'm going to work with it is to say, well, the anomaly is a one-dimensional higher invertible field theory. So when I said 3D, I really mean space-time dimension 3. So some people will say 2 plus 1. So the anomaly theory is 3 plus 1 dimensional. So space-time is 4 dimensions. And it's invertible. And so invertible here is saying, well, it may not be trivial, but it's not very far from trivial. So there's a precise sense that I'm not going to get into. Yeah?
Your notion of algebraic symmetry, do you want me to start with a group homomorphism, or are you thinking of starting with a monoidal one-factor?
So is the difference between, like, a categorical action, like a, is it one of,
Is G just a group for you here? Is this algebraic symmetry just a group homomorphism, or is it a boundary?
I think I want to say it's just a group homomorphism.
Okay.
I hope that's the correct answer to your question.
Either one would be fine.
Okay, if something seems weird later, let me know, and then I can adjust the answer. Sorry.
The anomaly will show up if you one level higher, so either way we're
good. Okay, cool. Okay, thank you for asking. Who's got more questions? Yes?
Does G have to be injected?
You mean this thing?
Yes.
Definitely not, but those are the most interesting cases, I think. Yeah. Did you have a question?
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, so this is kind of operating under the assumption that field theoretic symmetries are kind of smaller than algebraic symmetries.
What do you mean?
Like all field theoretic symmetries are to be described algebraic symmetries.
Okay, yes, I see. Right, and I did say stronger rather than, yeah, okay. So in practice,
I believe that for TFTs. But
okay, we only thought about TFTs in this project.
Okay.
Certainly the way that we thought about this was to start with the algebraic symmetry and try and strengthen it. So if that's not a surjective function, that's sort of, that doesn't end up changing very much except for I should have written this bullet point differently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it is different for QFTs, you say? Okay,
yeah.
That's interesting. Okay, that's good to know. Were there more questions? Yeah.
What if there are symmetries that does not permute anions at all, just assign charges to anions?
Yeah, so this isn't just the permutations of the anions. There's because there's all the extra data in C, and that's part of the automorphisms. Did that address your question?
I'm just saying for that kind of symmetry, wouldn't this homomorphism be trivial?
Well, so the point is that's still an automorphism. You're doing something to the category that is not the identity. So it's not it's a non-identity element of this group.
I see.
Yeah. If I'm understanding correctly, the thing that you had in mind, which I think. Were there more questions at this point? Yeah.
Is there a version of axiom for TFT that the two agrees, allowing the projective action?
So relating these things to projective actions.
Yeah.
Is Jackson here? Jackson is the person to talk to. Yeah. So I mentioned Jackson because he recently wrote two papers that carefully relate when exactly these things are the same and different. So I don't know the correct answer, but I think it's to be found there. Yeah. Yes?
Just to be clear, the symmetry fractionalizes on anions, but it doesn't permute them, and that still corresponds to a non-trivial map from G to O. So OTC is not the same as the Picard.
Okay, at this point you've caught me. I don't know what fractionalization means. So the point is that is what you're saying, I can have a symmetry where the anions are left in place, but I do something interesting nevertheless?
Yes.
Yeah, that's fine.
Well, I think that case corresponds to G being just non-split to group. Non-split to group. Instead.
No. So
yeah.
I can tell you, I've been thinking about this really naively. I have a group here, no two group, no whatever, just I have some things that act by automorphisms on an object, which is really a set with some structure. I probably should not see a category as a set with some structure, but that is how, I'm telling you, I'm thinking about this as naively as possible. I got a thing and something mixes it up, and I want to know whether that's really a symmetry. And so, what things does this act on? I don't know. Maybe I guess what I'm saying is the framework that I started with is not really sensitive to these kinds of questions, if that helps clarify some of these questions. I don't know. Does this answer your question?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. All right. More questions or should I go on? Okay. So really what I want to do is I want to be able to talk about invertible field theories. So, and I mean this in the sense of in the sense that of Atiyah and Siegel, where I have a Bordism category and I have a symmetric modal functor into something like vector spaces. And the something like there is carrying a lot of weight, but that's not the point of this talk. And again, I'm not promising anything about everything called an anomaly. I'm saying some of them. And I'm saying these ones that we're talking about today. So the reason that I want to think about anomalies in terms of invertible field theories is that we know what the invertible field theories are. So if you're looking at unitary things, then there's a theorem of Fried-Hopkins who say that that an invertible field theory, which has the Wick rotated version of unitarity, which is called reflection positivity, first of all, this thing is known by its partition functions. So if you want to know this field theory, all you have to do is compute it on closed manifolds. And moreover, you only have to compute it on very few closed manifolds. So the partition function is something called a Bordism invariant, which means that if two manifolds are related by what's called a Bordism, meaning that together they are the boundary of some compact manifold in one dimension higher, so then alpha of M is going to be equal to alpha of N. So this is kind of, you know, this equivalence relation on the domain of the partition function. It's really nice because the set of equivalence classes, in fact, has a abelian group structure given by disjoint union, right? N is a disjoint union of two circles, and it's very, very, very calculable. It turns into a question in algebraic topology, where you say, okay, I'm interested in the following kind of structure, oriented, spin, whatever. There's a machine where you feed in what kind of structure you want on your manifolds. You essentially turn the crank and you get out what's the set of equivalence classes? And with a little more work, what are some generators, what are some manifolds that represent equivalence classes? So if you have a group action on a category and you want to know the anomaly, you know, I'm not saying how you do it, but you only have to check it on a very few number of manifolds. For example, once you know it on M, you don't have to bother with N. So again, and that comes from the classification of invertible field theories. There are several other works that where people have studied the classification of invertible field theories in related but sometimes distinct settings. So I wanted to mention them because they're all worth looking at. And so I've mentioned anomaly indicators in the abstract, and I'm going to mention it a lot. So what is an anomaly indicator? Well, it's the formula for the value of the anomaly invertible field theory on our small list of manifolds that represent all equivalence classes. Or actually, we can do better, because the anomaly, I said this is an abelian group. The partition function will be a group homomorphism. So we only need a generating set for that abelian group. So our seemingly large problem, calculate this on all four manifolds with some structure, turns into check it on, like, I don't know, three or four things. Sometimes one thing. In the example we'll do later, one thing. So that's the goal, is let's figure out some formulas and then evaluate them. So what I'm going to say now is, okay, what's done, what's new, what's not new? So the problem that I've told you, to an extent it's settled in that, okay, for a lot of common choices of groups, for example, if you wanted to do like Z mod 2, then this whole story has been written out. There's a formula. You can look it up in a paper. You can use it to actually compute if you have a G action of interest. So I mentioned the toric code one. You know, that if I understand correctly, it does, the anomaly does vanish. And so you do get the field theoretic notion of Z2 symmetry. But, you know, the point is that story is just told. And moreover, there is a general procedure. If you have a category and you have a symmetry of it, and it's some like group of order, I don't know, 100 that you've never seen before, there are, you know, then go check out some of these works where they describe how to figure out a generating manifold a set of generating manifolds for the Bordism question, and then produce formulas on them for the anomaly. And so when I say formula, I mean in terms of the combinatorial data that defines your tensor category and the extra combinatorial data that says, well, what is the group action? So the bosonic problem, meaning for oriented TFTs, for modular tensor categories in the usual sense, you know, it's relatively settled. I like spin structures, and things are very different if I want to look at spin TFTs. And so this corresponds to the notion of fermionic topological order, and things are a lot harder. So one of the ways in which things are harder is that the procedure first that settles this problem, you know, key parts are missing. And so I'll say more about that. But also, the Bortism computations are a bit harder. So depending on the thing you're looking at, that can be anywhere from an irrelevant to a very hard obstacle. But it's just a thing to note. And so I want to mention, look, there's been lots of work studying the bosonic case. Some of these papers also look at specific special cases for fermionic. And there's this really nice work of Sri Tata, Ryohei Kobayashi, Justin Bomash, and Maisam Barkeshli, which really digs into this and says, okay, well, what if we actually try and do something general in the fermionic case? So I wanted to give a shout out to that paper. So, okay. So we're interested in the fermionic case corresponding to a supermodular tensor category. So essentially that's saying that there's a fermion and there's some conditions on it. I'll say a little more about later. And so what do we do? I would love to say, oh, we solved the problem, but we didn't. What we did was, given the input data, the algebraic action, then what we produce is what we hope is the anomaly field theory. What I know is that we produced a 4D topological field theory, which is an invariant of that data, and a way to actually compute formulas for this thing, given a Kirby diagram. So if you know your generator for the Bortism group, and you can turn it into a Kirby diagram, then there's a formula for what is the purported anomaly TFT of the data. So the question is, okay, I have some TFT over here, which is what we did, and then there's the actual anomaly out here. Are they the same? I sure hope so. And we produced a conjecture, which we think is reasonable, it sounds reasonable, and from which it follows that these two are the same. So we definitely have an invariant, we hope it's the right one, and here's why we believe it, part one. Part two, why do we believe it, is, well, we did a bunch of calculations, and they agree with prior work by other methods. And so I'll say a little bit about that at the end. This was one of the most fun parts of the project, was getting to do some fun calculations. Question?
Are there any limitations to trying to answer this problem by looking at how the group action translates onto the minimal modular extension of the fermionic topological order? Besides the fact that that might be hard.
Sorry, I just, I have not thought about that. That's a really good question.
I do not think modular extension appears anywhere in the project.
That's a good question.
Is it?
Yeah, we use the data of the original super MTC, and we do not need any modular extension, the data of the modular extension.
But I guess, is the question, could that also help, like as a different way of solving the problem?
Yeah, like could that also help, or are there limitations of that approach?
Honestly, I don't know. That's an interesting question. The worry I have is that, like, this sounds like a really good idea in principle, and the question that I have is, well, how much more complicated does this make the formulas? And I mean, it might be case by case. It might be that it's always, simple enough to work. It might be that it's often too complicated. I really have no idea. That's a great question.
Let me make sure I understand the question. I asked him, suppose I start from the fermion topological order, and I gauge the fermion parity. Basically, you're asking whether if I have two different anomalies at the beginning, will I get the same anomaly afterwards?
Yeah, well, I guess there's also the translation of how the symmetry acts in the fermionic topological order to how it acts in the minimal modular extension.
So there's an obstruction to that, extending a symmetry from a super MTC to any minimal modular extension. It's sort of explained in the paper by Galindo and Venegas Ramirez. And sort of just trivializing that obstruction is going to be the same as some sort of comparison between spin and SL versions of what I think we're about to hear about.
Okay.
So the same difference.
So you could have also detected these anomalies by showing that the symmetry, there's an obstruction to lift.
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly what anomaly we're about to hear, but there is always an obstruction, and there can be an obstruction to finding a G-equivariant minimal non-degenerate extension.
I think we will learn more about your question and the answer to it later. We'll see, but, like, because we have an approach which is related to gauging fermion parity, and so that might be, oh, that's what we're doing. It might be something different in mind. I don't know. Sorry for the half answer at best. Has anyone got more questions?
So the anomaly indicators, like in the bosonic case itself, those anomalies, does it live in this H4 homology group or even more general than that?
So some of them are, in some cases you get in cohomology formulas. But we're saying, okay, rather than compute this cohomology class on all manifolds, I want to find one case which tells us whether it's what the value is on everything. That's sort of the philosophy. But certainly the cases that I find most interesting are the ones that where cohomology doesn't tell you enough information. And so that the stuff that I'm going to mention today is one of those. Yeah. So okay, why don't I go on and say a little more about the bosonic case, which is not the thing that we're doing, but which is a good place to start. So the first thing is, if I want to specify a group homomorphism on a unitary modular tensor category, it's not enough to say just a group. You also need this extra data specifying, okay, sort of the type of the action. Which elements of the group act by a unitary symmetry or by an anti-unitary symmetry? This is something that Luke was getting at in his previous talk. And so somehow there's like, given a group, there's multiple different types of group actions based on the extra data of what do I require to preserve unitarity and what do I require to reverse it. So then there's the question of, I said a field theoretic symmetry is saying coupled to a G-bundle, but in the presence of anti-unitarity, you got a twist. Specifically, you need the anti-unitary part of G to act in an orientation reversing manner. And so, from a manifold's perspective, you say that you extend from an oriented TFT to a TFT on manifolds with a BGA twisted orientation. So you have your principal G bundle, and you just specify that the anti-unitary part of G acts, by orientation reversing. And what you do is you say, take your principal G bundle, extract from it a principal Z2 bundle by the homomorphism, and that must be the orientation bundle. So if this is, if this is getting your head turned around, A nice special case to think about is where A is trivial, and then this is just a principal G-bundle. You don't have to worry about it. So the point is, this extension, the obstruction is an invertible TFT on the same kind of manifolds, or manifolds of the BGA twisted orientation in dimension 4. And so we want to study, we want to get at these Bordism invariants. So the example, this maybe is getting at your question of like, well, what do these formulas actually look like? So if you want to do Z2 time reversal symmetry, that corresponds to the group is Z2. And well, I want the non-trivial element of Z2 to act anti-unitarily. And so this has been studied in plenty of works. Here's two of them. So what is a BZ2A twisted orientation? Well, it's a principal Z2 bundle. And after I change it by the identity homomorphism, it's the orientation bundle. So the bundle has to be the orientation bundle. And that's not any extra data. You always have that on a manifold. So we're just looking at unoriented Bordism, René Thom style, and it's generated by RP4 and CP2. So for RP4, it is possible to write down this formula as Wang and Levin did. And for CP2, you have a different formula. So here, what is going on? D is the total quantum dimension. I can look at the quantum dimension of any anion. I have the thetas, and then there's this sign here, where if I fix an anion, I can ask, okay, well, on that anion, how does the action rho, is it the identity there? Does it square to the identity? Is it plus one or minus one? So there are these two formulas. And I put this up here to illustrate, okay, RP4 and CP2, they're pretty simple manifolds. This is roughly how complicated the formulas are. Let me see. So, okay, where do these formulas come from? So like I mentioned, for the bosonic case, there is a general procedure. And so one thing you can do is you could say, okay, I take my generating manifold, I triangulate it, and now I feed that to the machine. And the machine is something called the Crane-Yetter TFT. And then Bomash and Barkeshley also have a procedure doing this in a more generality than Crane and Yetter did. Another thing you can do is you can use Kirby diagrams. And so Wei Cheng Ye and Liu Junzhou did this thing, where if you take a Kirby diagram of your four manifold, you can get out a formula. And so a totally vague but still useful heuristic is the simpler your generator is, measured either from a perspective of triangulations or from the perspective of the size of the Kirby diagram, the easier your formula is for the anomaly. And, you know, how bad is this? The question of, I have a kind of Bordism, how complicated are the generators, is the kind of math question that sounds nice and actually seems quite hard in general. So what I can tell you is that with heuristics, you know, you do a bunch of examples and you're like, yeah, this isn't too bad. So again, for the bosonic story, life's good. You've got a formula. It's typically like, you know, it might be bad, but at least in examples, it seems fine. You know, I feel very much like I'm sort of swimming on the surface of the water and not really looking at how deep it is, but, you know, it's working in practice for now. So now I want to talk about things that change in the fermionic case. And, you know, things are going to get a little more interesting, but let's just see what happens. So in the spin version, I want to insist that I have a super MTC, so it's a braided fusion category. Its Muegge center is super vector spaces. And so the odd line in SVECT is giving us the fermion that people like to talk about. So okay, first of all, super MTC has a canonical Z2 action. And it's the thing that people call -1 to the F, and it's tensoring with the fermion. So in particular, if I have a G action on a super MTC, well, first of all, do elements act unitarily or anti-unitarily? Well, that's a thing to know. But second, it could get mixed up with fermion parity. So one thing you could have is you could have, for example, if I have a Z2 acting, you know, in addition to saying, does it act unitarily or anti-unitarily, you also want to know, is it really a Z2 action? Or is it only a projective Z2 action, where instead of getting x squared as 1, I get x squared as -1 to the F? So that gives you four, you know, 2 times 2 is 4 possibilities. So the type of our action is the following. It's a group, it's a map to Z2 like before, and it's an extension by fermion parity. Classified, and so that extension class is a degree 2 cohomology class, B. And so what we have is the data. This data keeps showing up over and over again in lots of different places. Specifically, it was studied by Benson and Stoltz back in the 80s. And then Luke Stiehauer, I think, was the first to sort of really, you know, clean it up, sort of formalize a lot of the ways that physicists talk about fermionic symmetries, and it's the notion of a fermionic group. So Luke actually mentioned this, you know, like 40 minutes ago, maybe not in exactly these words, but sort of this data in the classification of low-dimensional topological field theories.
So the fermion parity is integrated.
Let me think about that. It's quite possible that I wrote this down wrong, but I think what I do think I want to say tensoring with the fermion, but I. What?
That's something Kerrigan you can do, like just reiterate saying that.
Oh, so the problem is if I calling this -1 to the F is the thing that's a little bit controversial.
Minus one to the F is a 0.2.
Yeah.
Yes, so that's the line. The whole line in SVECT is like tensoring the transparent, isn't it tensoring with the transparent?
I think that's correct.
That's not like
Is part of the problem you want -1 to the F to be a one-form symmetry?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, this is just a genuinely, yeah, okay. I think we both agree this is a different thing. Maybe I should have called it something else. Yeah. So, sorry about that. Yeah?
At least the equation does look in this format. Does it mean this little pin blasted at the minus this definitely be different because shifting A by A squared?
Yes, that's exactly how you, yeah. So somehow, like, yeah. Wait, did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Who's got more questions? All right. So you have a group action, and really what you need to keep track is of the data of G and these two cohomology classes. Incidentally, this is also exactly the data, these two cohomology classes, that define a twist of real K-theory over the classifying space BG. So none of this is a coincidence, but somehow all of these things are showing up in like they're all related in some way. We don't need K-theory in this today, but you know, you can, if you end up looking at spin Bordism, sometimes looking at the twisted real K-theory is a useful thing to do. So all these, this data shows up in a lot of places. And on manifolds, what is the data? The data is a twisted spin structure. So we have a principal, we have a principal G bundle, this should say, I'm sorry. And the same condition on the orientation bundle, now expressed in terms of characteristic classes, and now there's also a condition on W2. And so this notion was first defined by Bailing Wang, maybe 15 years ago. And so, you know, it's a twist. It's, if you had two cohomology classes, this is what you would say for a twisted spin structure. You know, there's the only question of like, do I put W1 squared here or not? Like, what's spin plus and what's spin minus? This turns out to be the right thing to do. So to summarize, I have a group acting on a super MTC. I get this data, and I want to extend this, the theory, to a theory of manifolds with this structure. So now there's some problems. So let's look at the simplest possible example. Let's say that G is the trivial group. So what is a trivial twist of spin structure? That's a spin structure. And it's been long known what the generator of the corresponding Bordism group is. So there's an integer valued invariant, and the generator is what's called the K3 surface. So so I'm going to say a little bit more about this in a sec, but what do we know about, so how do you know this? Well, one way to detect it is by an invariant called the A roof genus. Sometimes people like to call it the index of the Dirac operator. And so now we get to finish the joke. So if you'll recall, Luke began with the talking dog, who when asked what is his favorite spin Bordism invariant, said ARF. So the bartender looks at the dog and looks at the man, and the man says to the dog, I think you should try a different one. And the dog says, A roof. And so the bartender throws him out, and the dog looks at the man and says, so next time, why don't I say index of the Dirac operator? So the thing about the K3 surface is it's messy. Like, if you're just doing algebra like I like to do, okay, it's one, and one is a nice number. But if you're doing topology, if you want to write down a formula for an anomaly indicator on K3, you got to turn this thing into algebra. Now, remember the formulas we had for RP4 and CP2? They're not trivial formulas, but RP4 and CP2 have like some of the simplest Kirby diagrams that I've ever seen. So this is going to be bad. In fact, so bad that this is like not, as I understand, this is like not tractable. Like, maybe in principle there's a formula, but no one's done it, no one's used it. It just seems too much. So if you're wondering what this thing is, this is expressing the K3 surface as a handle body. So you start off with some number of balls, you join them by one handles, you add two handles all the way up, and this is sort of a combinatorial way to encode that data. And so the K3 surface, one way to think about it is the K3 surface has a big intersection form, right? It has to have a large, by Roeland's theorem, it has to have a big signature, which tells you it has to have a big intersection form, so H2 has to be big. So there's lots and lots of two handles. This is at least how I think about it, but I'm not a four-manifold theorist. So if this is a bad way to think about K3, I'm sorry in advance. Question?
You can't even get like a computer to do this for you?
Maybe. I don't know. I've not tried. I'm a little scared to. Wei Cheng, do you know what? Okay. No, as in you don't know, or no, it's not possible.
I think it may be possible, but it requires some coding that I do not have.
So, for perspective, at the end of the talk, I'm going to show you a manifold with a Kirby diagram that's maybe like 1/10 of the size of this, and the formula is already quite messy. So, I think you're right that you could do it with a computer, but there's a reason that no one has. If that answers your question.
I guess it just seems like, for example, if you wanted to compute the Carlson-Tretar charge for the fermionic topological order, then you want to get like partition function on that manifold, and there's no other way to do it, then you might want to write a program to do it. But I don't know if that's just obstructed by it because it's so hard or something.
So I think you're right that it's not this is impossible, and rather this is really hard. And the key thing is you said if there's no other way to do it. And so what I understand is that people are trying to avoid doing this. So there's a math overflow answer where Kevin Walker talks about essentially something related to this. And what he said is that he was going to try and say, okay, well, can I replace spin with something more general where my theory still makes sense, the the field theory, and where the generators are simpler. And so that's an approach that might bear fruit and might lead to simpler generators. And so the hope is that you can do that, and then you don't have to know, like, or at least I don't have to know how to program. I don't know. I can't speak for anyone else.
So when you say that K3 generates it, just do people pick K3 because it's a nice manifold after it has a model of KB diagram? I mean, could it be a simple KB diagram with also the next?
That's a really good question. So I don't have a definitive answer, but I'm very skeptical that one would exist, and here's why. So Roeklin's theorem says that spin 4 manifolds, the signature is always divisible by 16. And in fact, K3 realizes it. So K3 has the smallest signature. Now, the signature is signature 16n is telling you that H2 is huge, right? And these are all telling you that H2 is big, right? They're telling you two handles. So I mean, maybe one of the 4 manifold topologists will post a paper on archive tomorrow that says a simpler generator of 4-dimensional spin Bordism. I can't rule that out from the argument I gave, but I'd be very shocked. Go. Too many.
Sorry. So the anomaly indicator you're trying to compute is now instruction to lifting algebraic symmetry to this TFT that you define, right?
Yes. And so you're saying, well, if there's no.
Yeah. If there's G equals one, what is it compute?
Great question. I think I didn't explain this super well in this slide. The problem is not when G is 1. If I started with a spin TFT, there's no obstruction to lifting to a spin TFT. But because this generates spin Bordism, it's likely to show up as a generator for twisted spin Bordism. So for example, let's say I have Z mod 8, and it acts, and the generator acts anti-unitarily, and there's no mixing with fermion parity. Then the Bordism group is Z2 plus Z2. This guy's one of the generators. The other is tractable. So that's the reason, is it's like, okay, you don't need it here, but you do need it in some cases, and that's a headache that personally I would love to find a workaround for.
Okay.
Yeah. More questions? Okay, so I can't handle the K3, so let's, you know, get rid of it. Here is another problem that I don't know how to do, which is, so the bosonic anomaly indicator story passes through Crane-Yetter theory. Spin Crane-Yetter theory doesn't exist yet. And it looks like it's going to be a significant undertaking. Not in the sense of like, oh, this is going to be some major open, like, no one knows, has any idea how to do it. Like, the state sum people are good. I bet they can do this. It just seems like it's going to be a long, complicated story. Even for oriented Crane-Yetter, it does feel like everyone, like, every so often you see this, like, 70-page long paper, which irons out some detail in the definition of Crane-Yetter, in, like, on two manifolds or something. And so it seems like already, even in the oriented story, there's a lot of details, and the spin story is going to be even more details. So that's another problem that we need to avoid. Really, the theme seems to be: I encounter a difficulty, I say, "Oh gosh," and try and like run away. And in running away, maybe we do some interesting mathematics. So we're going to do something different. So the problem is the spin structure. So let's make the spin structure go away. And so, you know, this is like it was already mentioned, gauging fermion parity. But let's do this in a way that allows us to come back. So there's this construction due to Gyodo and Kapustin called the bosonic shadow construction. And we're going to use a generalization due to Tada, Kobayashi, Bomash, and Barkeshli, which allows us to keep track of the G bundle as well. So in summary, in words, I'll say this in slide later, but the summary is, I know how to do bosonic anomaly indicators, but I don't know how to do fermionic ones. Well, let's bosonize, and then do the story in the bosonic case, and then fermionize. And the question is, does that work? And well, that's where the conjecture comes in. But we think it does. So, okay, I am not convinced that this slide is the right way, is the most convenient way to explain it. So I'm going to try and draw it a little differently. So let's say that I have a spin TFT. That's the same thing as it's a boundary for the theory obtained by gauging the fermion parity for the trivial theory. And if I have an oriented TFT with a Z2 bundle, well, you can do the same thing with Z2 on twisted digraph-Witten theory. So bosonization and fermionization, what I'd like to do is I'd like to be able to exchange them, you know, by some process that is going to be like a Fourier transform in a lot of ways, including that I can invert it and that it doesn't play well with multiplication. So you do that by positing the existence of a defect for the two for the two sim TFTs. So here is my defect, z alpha, and then I put fz2 here. Sorry, Davide. Is this okay? So you say, okay, I have my theory that I wanna bosonize in this case. So I bring this in here, and then I sort of push this together. I bring this together, and now I have a theory at the boundary of fz2. So I take my theory, which is at the boundary of f spin, I tensor with this defect, and I get a theory at the boundary of z2. And I could reverse the direction of this and go from bosonic to fermionic. And now the wonderful thing is, this thing has a, it nearly squares to the identity. The difference is an Euler theory, which is easy to make go away. And so you can really, in two dimensions, you can really exchange SO times z2 and spin TFTs. This process is not symmetric monoidal, but that's okay. So the way that I originally learned to think about it was you tensor with a specific invertible field theory and sum over spin structures, or tensor and then sum over z2 bundle. So this is sort of the inspiration. Everything is really nice in dimension two. Things are a little more elaborate in higher dimensions. And so that's what I'm going to do next. But does anyone have any questions? So in higher dimensions, again, this is due to Gaiuro and Kapustin. So the problem is, so in two dimensions, every oriented manifold has a spin structure. Not canonically, but this means that like the process of trying to go from an oriented TFT on a specific manifold to a spin TFT, like there's no obstruction. The problem, I mean, in three dimensions, this is fine, but like doesn't play well enough with the whole Bordism category point of view. And in higher dimensions, it's just hopeless. Lots of oriented non-spin manifolds, like CP2. So on the bosonic side, what you need to do is, well, first of all, you say instead of a principal Z2 bundle, I have a principal Z2 like gerb or higher bundle, or like my Z2 zero form symmetry has become a Z2 higher form symmetry. And moreover, the untwisted Dyckgraff-Witten theory we put here is replaced with a twisted one. So we're at the boundary of a twisted Dyckgraff-Witten theory, aka the oriented theory is anomalous. So this is it's very much like being a vec G versus a vec G omega module. Like which one of these has a genuine G symmetry and which one of these has an anomalous G symmetry. So then there's the question of, okay, can you set up the analogous defect? And that's what Gaiuro and Kapustin do. It works. And so you really do get this operation, and it really is still essentially its own inverse. So what Tada Kobayashi Bomash Barkeshli did is they said, well, let's throw in a G bundle. This G should be capital, I'm sorry. And so we go from, so we incorporate the twists. Twisted spin TFTs, twisted oriented TFTs. I'm very sorry. I don't know why both, why the, hopefully these are the only two typos in this document. I'm sure they won't be now, but now that I've asked for it. So yeah, sorry about that. And so again, the key thing to notice is on the oriented side, things are anomalous. And crucially, this construction is very far from symmetric monoidal. Think about the Fourier transform. The Fourier transform exchanges pointwise multiplication and convolution. And the same thing is true here. If you have a TFT with like a Z2 gauge field, in the maybe I need the degree of the thing to be correct, you can define a convolution style product on it. And it ought to be symmetric monoidal. I can't say theorem because I haven't proven it, but it ought to be symmetric monoidal. And then bosonization and fermionization, well, they change which symmetric monoidal structure you have. And in that sense, they're symmetric monoidal. This is an idea that came from a paper of Ryan Thorngren, as far as I know. But that's the first place I read about it. It may have appeared elsewhere earlier. So just like the Fourier transform exchanges multiplication and convolution, this thing exchanges the usual stacking product or tensor product of TFTs with some other product. And so if you start with an invertible theory, the thing we were after, there's no guarantee that what you get out at the other end is invertible. Typically, it isn't. So that is kind of a headache. So this is what I said earlier. Here's our heuristic approach. And this is really, should this work? You have every right to be skeptical. Because I just told you, if you take your theory and you bosonize, and then you do anomaly indicators there where you have a Crane-Yetter theory, and then you fermionize, why should that be good? We just destroyed invertibility. And now I'm saying, wait, When I go backwards, everything should just work again. So look at this. We bosonized a 3D theory, and then we fermionized the 4D theory. There should be some sort of, absent some sort of strong compatibility guarantee for this, why should these things be related at all? You know, we did two different constructions that just happen to be going in the correct directions, but they may not be related. And of course, I think they are. The evidence backs it up. But this is, my point is this, if you're thinking this looks a little funny, I get that, and that's okay. And so the thing I wanted to mention is, at what point do we do the sort of the concrete, given a manifold, write down the formula, and it's before fermionization. So this way you can use the Kirby diagram stuff that Wei-Chung and Liu-Chung did in the bosonic case, and then infer something in the fermionic case. So again, to reiterate, we definitely produced a four-dimensional field theory. It's just, is it the right one?
So this bosonization step is choosing the minimal longitudinal extension? Is that what happened there?
So I always thought of these differently, but that may be because I don't understand minimal non-degenerate extensions. I think of it as like, when I sum over over spin structures, that's losing information. So I want to keep track of what's the dual information that allows me to go backwards. So when you say minimal modular extension, do you keep track of that like anomalous higher Z2 symmetry?
I think it's the thing that, for me, a supermodular tensor category somehow doesn't have a well-defined sum over spin structures.
I guess I'm thinking about this in terms of TFT, where there is.
If you just give me a supermodular tensor category, there's like only anomalous TFT.
Oh, is this the problem with like the framing anomaly? Okay, I should have mentioned this at the beginning. I've been like in this paper we ignore that, and there's that's sort of a separate question to ask.
Okay, because the paper by Plovnik and Roll and others explains that there are 16 minimal non-degenerate extensions.
Yes.
And they're indexed by the lift of the framing anomaly. So they differ by central charge, like the empty seat.
Oh, so the 16 and the 16-fold weight.
This
is Roeland's theorem.
Yeah, this is
okay.
So it's like lifting against Roeland's theorem is the choice you have to make.
So because these those invertible field theories you can sort of deform to so we didn't really worry about those, but yeah, that is a thing that would be good to take care of. Yeah.
I feel that idea of organizing a field was anomalous.
Yeah. So
you can say this is having more engagement between yeah, so I guess.
The reason that this should work is there's no anomaly in just spin. It's just the G part that's anomalous. So somehow you're really saying something like, I'm at the boundary of a twisted spin theory, and that pair of things is what I'd like to bosonize. So it's kind of fragile, actually.
Are you caring about the mixed anomalies?
What do you mean by mixed anomaly here?
G and spin structure.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess the conclusion is, as Theo said, sometimes there's an obstruction to even lifting the G action to the bosonized theory. And on the other hand, in this case, you always seem to be able to do that, and you map every fermionic anomaly onto some bosonic one. But why would I expect that to be true?
I see. And so the problem is that there's this, like, usually it's sort of a 1/16th chance of being true. Kind of question?
Like, usually there's also anomalies in the fermionic theory that don't have analog in the bosonic one, right? But now somehow you're mapping every...
Like, yeah, and so what happened? No, this is a, okay, this is a really good question. Let me
see. It's possible that this obstruction is almost hidden in the general, like, is it a fear? There's probably some generalized cohomology theory that he's using. It's possible that this obstruction to lift to bosonization at all isn't there.
So do you mean in the sense like the anomaly lives in some sort of like cobordism spectrum? Okay. That sounds, I think that's the correct answer to your question.
Obstruction lifting is sort of seen in lower degrees. Like it's, you know, it's like the very first one is just a sort of Z2 obstruction about whether the symmetry even kind of preserves the central charge at all, and then there's a sort of next one, and so on. So I think those are going to end up in the lower terms. And
so you're saying those would not be like captured by these invariants?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what is a invariant is, but there's a chance that it's like, I know sort of the obstruction to lifting, to extending the G-symmetry to a minimal integer.
Is that part of the spec?
Like,
yes, okay.
It's like the kind of, you know, it's sort of, you can see it in the kind of low level, like Majorana level of the super homology class.
Okay, I think that is the correct answer in that if you, so there is this, people have studied these anomalies by saying, okay, let's say I filter it in the Atiyah-Herzberg filtration, I've got a bunch of different cohomology groups. What does the value of the anomaly in each of those groups mean? And one of them is exactly that, that extension that you're asking about. So.
It must be hidden in both of the two slides, right?
Yeah. So
it's correspondence.
Yeah. And so like if in a specific example, what would happen is that the obstruction would be, you know, the anomaly we're measuring as a Bordism invariant, and part of that data is the obstruction you were asking about. So that is, I think, the answer to your question. I want to, you know, if you'd like, we can talk about it afterwards, just to make sure that I'm not telling you an untruth, or that like we're referring to the same things.
Apply to anomalous BGT. Because like, I'm a bit confused now too. So if, on the left hand side, you didn't specify anything about the anomaly.
Right.
And then you say on the right hand side, I will specify the anomaly.
Oh, so there's multiple different anomalies going on here. So this is the analog of a square two anomaly, which is different than the anomaly indicator that we're trying to do, where I have an anomalous symmetry.
Does it also
this anomaly?
Does it also mix a specific Q with PG?
They're mixed in a pretty mild way. I think the formula is the integral of what is it, square two, x plus it's like b times x, where b is the I have a principal G bundle, so I can pull back my characteristic classes, and then I pull back b. Did that answer your question?
I think so.
Okay. I mean, again, maybe we can also talk about it afterwards. More questions?
I'm not sure about the answer, the interaction between this version and the version of the previous two questions. But yeah.
Okay. Hopefully that's okay for now. Shall I go on? All right. So this is our plan, is this sort of bosonized, anomaly indicators, fermionized, and see whether that works. And to be clear, we were not the first people to try this. Like Tada Kobayashi, Bomash, Brakesh did do their construction with anomaly indicators in mind. So what we did, just to sort of recap, what did we, okay, how much time do I have? I have, oh, not a lot, all right. So first the thing that's really a theorem. And the theorem I already mentioned is that this construction that we did really produces a four-dimensional topological field theory on manifolds with the correct twist of spin. And moreover, you have a particular manifold you're after, you have a Kirby diagram, and a little bit of extra data representing this BG twist, AB twisted spin, there's a formula. Great. So that part's the theorem. Now, I think the real key thing about this is the conjecture, which is we produced something. Is it even invertible? We don't know. We spent some time trying to prove it. And because bosonization and fermionization play very badly with invertibility, this is, you know, a priori, there's no reason to expect it. So it's quite nice that in all the examples that we looked at, it is. And so this is kind of, you know, it's a little bit spooky. We did something. It shouldn't work. Maybe it should. I don't know. But it does. Even if you know it's invertible, does this even have anything to do with the anomaly? Right? We just produced some four-dimensional field theory. Is it the right one? I hope so. But we spent some time thinking about this, and we found a reasonable conjecture, something that we think is true, something that seems right, and it does imply both of these. So that's a reason to believe this procedure. So the heuristic slogan for the conjecture is that it ties together. If I have a bulk theory and a boundary theory, and I try and bosonize both of them, Well, first of all, even making sense of that is a little bit subtle. But if you do that, there are, you know, how are the anomalies related? And so if you take this naively and say, well, can I try and make sense of that? Like, that doesn't work. And so you have to modify it quite a bit to make it make sense. So what I'd actually like to do is, rather than talk about the conjecture per se, I would like to, so I'll just mention that there, naively, there's a problem in doing it, but you can make that problem go away by restricting the structure slightly. I'm going to talk more about examples in the last 5 or so minutes of the talk. So first of all, the first thing we looked at was the original tenfold way. And when I say tenfold way, there are many tenfold ways, but the tenfold way of like space-time symmetries was done by Fried Hopkins. So spin, pin plus, pin minus, 7 more. So various authors have studied they produced anomaly indicator formulas for the tenfold way fermionic groups. Our construction reproduces theirs, so that's a good sign. Then we did the new calculations for this group Z mod 4, generator acting anti-unitarily, no mix with fermion parity. And this recovers, this calculation we did, it matches computations done in 2 ways. First of all, Del Mastro and Gomez have studied symmetries of abelian churn Simons theories, and what we get is consistent with theirs. And secondly, there is this anomaly cascade method of Bulmash and Barkeshli, where you say, okay, this is the thing I mentioned to you earlier about the Atiyah-Herzebruch filtration, and their approach to discovering what is the anomaly agrees with what we did. So this is a good sign that our conjecture is on the right track. So I want to specifically tell you about the Z4 example because it's close, because I thought it was cool, and so hopefully that'll be a good way to conclude the talk. But if not, at least it'll be over. So like I said, Z4 doesn't mix with fermion parity. It does act anti-unitarily. And why would you ever consider such a thing? Well, there's a bunch of examples of these things cooked up by Del Mastro and Gomez. So for example, U1 level 5 has this symmetry. So the space-time symmetry type is what's called an E-pin structure by Juyan Wan, Juven Wang, and Yun Chun Zheng. And the Bordism group, you know, I wanted to say it's been open since 1997, but that gives the problem a little more heft than it actually has. It's more that people first consider this in 1997, and from time to time, people come back to it and can't prove it. It's known that it's Z4 or Z2 plus Z2, but essentially, you know, no one was able to figure it out. So there's standard tricks for doing this, right? You say, okay, do the Atiyah-Herzebruch spectral sequence. Doesn't help. It leaves the ambiguity in place. Okay, you say, why don't I try doing the Adam spectral sequence? If you talk to me, you know that I love saying the Adam spectral sequence solved these problems for you, but it doesn't. It makes it still ambiguous. That is frustrating. Somehow, Z4 is way too simple for this to be so hard. Okay, great. So what do? You say, okay, there's a thing called an eta invariant. It helps in the cases that the Adam spectral sequence doesn't. Eta invariants are not helpful here. And that's this nice paper of Barrera-Yanez from a while ago. So like, how do you solve this problem? And this is kind of funny. Let me see. Yeah, so here's the Adam spectral sequence picture. The thing to note, here's the Klein bottle, here's the K3 surface. The thing to note is the vertical, this thing is what dimension am I in? So, and each dot is a Z2, and a vertical line means 2 Z2s are extended by a Z4. So for example, in dimension 1, the Bordism group is Z2. In dimension 2, there's a Z4 here, there's a Z2 here. They might be extended. In dimension 4, we see the K3 surface, we see another Z2 summand, and we don't know whether they are related. Z2 plus Z2 or Z4. The Adam spectral sequence is stubbornly unhelpful here. So like I said, Botvinnik and Gilkey did this a long time ago, and it's still, you know, who knows? So now you're thinking, why? Z2 times Z2 and Z4 are not that different as groups. You could just say, well, let me find a generating set irrespective of this ambiguity. If the ambiguity has existed for almost 30 years, maybe just work around it. But the problem is this. Botvinnik and Gilkey's argument implies if it's Z2 times Z2, the other generator is a K3. Look, K3. We don't want to deal with that. If this is Z4, then K3 is 2 times this, and we don't have to deal with it. So this distinction actually matters in terms of the tractability of our question. What's the anomaly of this action on U1 level 5 churn Simons? Well, it really depends. Whether we can address that with this framework really depends on whether you get this or not. So that's kind of funny. Anyways, turns out you don't have to worry about the K3. So specifically, we found that the group is Z mod 4, and we found the generator as a particular Klein bottle bundle over the sphere. So the way to do it is there is a U1 action on, U1, not S1, well, they're the same, There's a U1 action on the Klein bottle described in this way. I set it in terms of R mod Z, but you can exponentiate. And then take the associated bundle to the hop vibration over S2. So we then need to put an E-pin structure on it. This is essentially the one induced from the Klein bottle. So that's, you know, that's fine. I can tell you the E-pin structure on the Klein bottle is essentially, why don't I write it down? So the Klein bottle is what I get if I take a cylinder and I glue the wrong way. So what the orientation bundle is given by, well, I glue the right way, it's the torus. So why don't I just glue two copies of this to itself? That's a Z4 bundle, whose associated Z2 bundle is the orientation bundle. And then you need to say, okay, well, what's the spin structure? But it turns out you can, for this particular construction, you can pick whichever one. Not spin structure, twisted spin structure. But it doesn't really matter what I do on the two circles. So so that's part of the story. Then I put this on top of the sphere. That's the generator. Notice that this is not, I mean, this is a little bit complicated, but it's much simpler than the K3. So I'm going to finish up just by sort of finishing out the thing of saying, how do we do it? What's the formula? But how do we get the Z4 and how do we get the generator? And here I want to advertise a different project, joint with Sanat Devloperkar, Cameron Krulowski, who's here, Leon Liu, Natalia Pacheco-Talaj, and Ryan Thorngren, and that Cameron actually talked about at the Gong Show on Monday, where we used a long exact sequence related to the Smith homomorphism. So Cameron talked more about the physics applications, but you can sort of say, well, I don't know anything about physics. This is just a tool for generating long exact sequence of Bortism groups and use exactness and choose the right Smith homomorphism or just try all of them and see what helps. And it really seems to be filtering things differently than the usual techniques, Atiyah, Hertzberg, and Adams. And so, so you actually learn new things. So in particular, this Z4 relates to a computation someone else did a long time ago. And so you get E-pin with no spectral sequences. So I mentioned this earlier, but you get Z2 plus Z2 for Z8 or Z16. I'm going to finish up quickly. The point I just really wanted to show off, this is such a surprisingly effective technique. I wanted to mention it. So here's the Kirby diagram for our generator. Notice how much simpler it is in the Kirby diagram for the K3. It's much, much simpler. It's not trivial, but it's much simpler. But the formula is quite bad. So this is why no one wants to do K3. Look at how much simpler that was than the K3. Look at how bad this is. Imagine, like, do the analogy in your head. But the point is, this is definitely something you can ask a computer. And you get some formulas. For example, the Z4 action on U1 level 5, no anomaly. For semion fermion or for SO3 level 3, there is an anomaly. Here's what it is. And I am both out of time and out of slides. So thank you so much for your time and for your wonderful questions. And yeah, please let me know if you have any more questions.
So this is gonna sound kind of vague, but so I know that the Klein bottle is the classifying space of glides, the glide lattice.
Yep.
So given, you know, the vague understanding of Smith homes that I have, it seems I can get at E-pin Bortism groups by, for example, putting just a spin Bortism group with a glide symmetry.
Ah, okay. And then trying to go from there?
Yeah, trying to just send things there to E-pin or something.
So that is a good way to do this. It turned out that one way I like to think about generators is if I think I have a generator with a fundamental group, G, I could say, okay, what's the spin Bortism of BG? Does it map to the thing that I'm interested in? And maybe spin is twisted spin.
Yeah.
And so that is a fantastic way to prove that the Klein bottle generates that thing in degree two. I always think of that as a different direction than the Smith argument, because Smith usually, you know, turns unitary into anti-unitary, for example, or vice versa. I actually had not thought about putting the two of them in the same way, like trying to Smith with that glide symmetry. That's an interesting idea. I like it. So in summary, I don't know. Sorry.
So in that version, it's not really that the bosonization of an anomalous theory is relative to the bosonization of the anomaly, because I can sort of gauge the minimum sieve and the whole Do you really want the boson life theory to have an anomaly, so being relative to something?
I guess, wait, so what's, I've been thinking of those as very similar, right? If I have an anomaly, I'm relative to my anomaly theory. And so what, when you, what's the distinction you're trying to distinguish?
Well, especially in the sense that it may not be verified. It's not clear to me that the bosonization of a fermion, an anomalous bosonic theory can be thought of as an anomalous bosonic theory.
Because it might be non-invertible?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So that's part of the reason. Yeah. So, no, this is a good point, because like we said, well, we sure hope this is invertible, right?
Yes.
And that's the reason. So, yeah, like this would be really interesting. If our procedure produces a non-invertible field theory, well, I mean, that would be bad, but it'd be interesting. But it's more so that in all the cases we looked at, we got invertible field theories. And so we tried to prove it for a while, and then we said we should probably write this up. And so, it'd be a good thing to return to. But, I think that's sort of the key to the whole question. We did this very non-symmetric monodal procedure. We shouldn't get invertibility out very often. Why did we at all? And I wish I had a better answer for you about that, but it's something that I think it's the key to understanding the things that we don't yet understand.
So if it fails to be invertible, what would I invert?
Then our invariance, well, first of all, then there's two things. So the first is the partition function is not a Bortism invariant. So the anomaly indicators are somehow very little information about the TFT. They no longer control it. And second, well, we really expect that the anomaly of a G-symmetry is an anomaly. It's an invertible field theory. So that would be saying that whatever we're constructing is not actually the anomaly. We have some nice happy invariant and it's the wrong invariant. So that would be pretty dire, which is why it's so nice that in all the examples it isn't happening. Yeah.
Did you check your conjecture? So did similar computations in lower dimensions, let's say like 1+1 or even like 0+1?
We have not. That's a good idea. The trick is like, in dimensions sufficiently low, bosonization and fermionization, the problem that we've been talking about, the anomaly on the bosonic side, goes away. So that might be, while it's a good idea, it might be too good. I don't know if that I'm sorry if that's kind of vague. But to answer your question, no, we haven't checked, and that's a good idea. Are there more questions? Go for it. Yes. Wait, sorry, could you say that again? Mm-hmm. Okay. Where in our paper is that? So I think this is, I'm not the right person to ask about this. And
I believe that is correct.
Okay. Okay. Wei-Chung says that's correct. Yeah.
I think at least.
In terms of this thing? I'm not sure. Like, I don't really, I've not really thought deeply about the K3 case and like, what is this anomaly indicator detecting? I included it in here to give a scope of like how what problems should be more or less difficult. So I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I'm sorry.
That's not necessarily true, right? Like, that could also include things like the fusion coefficients and things like that.
You mean the K3 anomaly indicator?
Yeah,
okay.
It might not just be the topological spin effects.
Okay. Yes, I think that's correct. So that would be sort of like looking at the thing on the torus. Okay. Yeah, I guess that's, I mean, if it were easier, someone might have done something with it already, I guess. I don't know.
In this comment about the like, lower dimension situation in Laplace family, and there's a, say, spin times Z2 symmetry, and there's a generator of Z8 of the anomaly,
yeah.
And if you gauge the bosonized the system, then it's known that you get something non-invertible. So the symmetry of after bosonization is a rising category.
Oh, that's really interesting.
That's
and so,
because of the mixed anomaly.
That's because of mixed anomaly.
Oh, okay, okay.
The situation.
Where should I read about that?
That's there's several obvious.
Okay. Okay, that's good to know. Did people have more questions?
Let's thank a room for the talk.